So yeah, like I feel like I've been living. I mean, I don't know if you guys recall this. Remember when my transformer went out?
Yeah.
And I said, like, because of the car accident and other stuff, that I've been living in this just like clenched, full body clench, and that's how I've been for the last week. And relating to this, like, I sat down to read Heidegger last night, and it was very difficult. It was very difficult to just read it. And by the way, as you guys know, this isn't hard Heidegger.
Right? No.
This is like Heidegger at his easiest in kindness and gentleness. And I just found, it's just something I realized in terms of myself, like, I need certain types of conditions to be in place in order to be able to think with someone. I mean, it was really, the effect of it was therapeutic and it was great. It just was not pleasant. I mean, initially, my initial encounter, it's like, I just found myself reading, and obviously it relates to the content of what he's talking about. I found myself reading, it's like, what's the point? What's the point? Like, I want the point, and I wanted it fast. And you know, Heidegger, if nothing else, does not write fast, right? He writes
meticulously. Sort of, yeah,
that's right.
You would not want to be stuck in a car with him because you would never get off the scenic route.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But there's something really great to that. And the effect after, really, I'm not joking, like 20 minutes of kind of painful forcing myself to read the sentences over and over and over again because I was not extracting the message and not, you know, it slowed me down. And it was good. It was effective. And I think that the sort of larger point for me is that this is like, you know, that there is a mode of reading. He talks about it as a tone of that sentence, you know, hearing different tones. But there's a practice of reading that I understand why someone gets frustrated, why, you know, for instance, newcomers to this type of thinking get frustrated. Because it's frustrating. It doesn't work the same way. And you have to be in the mindset to be open to it being a kind of therapeutic, conceptual thinking practice.
Right.
To say, like, okay, I'm going to sit with this, and I'm going to, you know, because like I said, I really was rereading sentences, and these are not hard sentences, but I was rereading them multiple times because I'm like, I'm not attending to this, I am just trying to, like, quickly get it, and it took a good 20 minutes, but I will say, when I kind of got into the reading of it, I felt calmer, right, everything kind of went more smoothly after that.
Right.
So, I mean, thinking of reading philosophy as a kind of mental therapeutics, right? Like, is, I think, a really good way. I mean, the last time when we talked about this a year ago about the Transformer thing, I remember it was Nietzsche for me that I was turning to. But that's a really different, like, Nietzsche doesn't give me slowness in the way that Heidegger gives me slowness.
Yeah.
And I needed that given the anger of the stupidity of the administration's dealing with the COVID situation.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, let's keep this in, because, like, this is shocking. I mean, to me, it really is just shocking the level of, it's either stupidity or stubbornness, and I'm sure some combination of the two. But I kind of can't get over how I can't get over it. Like, when am I going to stop being surprised at the craven stupidity of people in positions of authority like university administrators in this particular case? But it's not only that. We could talk about the state house and the legislation, our attorney general, and all that sort of shit going on. And to me, it's like, this is why I need to talk about Heidegger. Or this is one of the sources, is because this is a kind, it is, it's therapeutic. This is a way of slowing down thinking and attention in a way that, frankly, just feels better.
It right? Does.
Like, it just feels better.
You know? And he encourages it both stylistically and, you know, in terms of the content, if you want to call it.
Conceptually, yeah.
You know? I do feel like, I mean, if we want to turn to it explicitly, like, yeah. I feel like there's a confidence to the writing stylistically, syntactically, that's almost comforting, because it's like, it feels like Heidegger at his best, even though it's not his most complex necessarily, or it's not his most confusing. He feels very assured in the kind of moves. Some of them are polemical, some of the mm-hmm. points you could obviously challenge, but it's like he is going to keep, and it feels fluid too, like you can follow the train of thinking.
Yep.
I don't know.
It's very, like, grandfatherly, right? Where you're not sure where he's taking you, but you feel comforted. Mm-hmm. And part of it is, you know, there's the simultaneous, like, comfort of, it seems like this guy knows what's going on. He's been down this path before, but also he's in the act of doing the thinking with you. So he's both with you and leading you at the same time.
Yeah.
I really like that analogy because it also explains the couple of times where it's like the grandfather makes the racist comment, but you just kind of let it go and roll your eyes and allow him to continue with the story. And you're like, well, that's just what the grandfather does. For me, that's his language of essence.
Right? Or authenticity.
Like So, but it didn't, I mean, remember the last time that we talked about it, like I was just so hung up on the piety, you know, but for whatever reason, this time in reading it, I still saw it. I still noted it, but I allowed it. I was like, okay, whatever. And you know, again, there are other stages that one can get, which is rethinking the notions of essence and authenticity. There are other, as we talked about, but for, you know, in this case, it is the grandfather analogy. It's like, oh yeah, okay, that's grandfather's racism, and you just let it go because that's not the point of the story.
Right.
The point of the story is something else, and it's just going to ruin everything if you force him to confront that.
So. I mean, it's a recurring theme and refrain, the kind of call to or a plea for an authentic relation to the world or to being. And of course, it's easily challengeable. But I think you're right. Like, it doesn't help you to read Heidegger in that way, like to chastise him every time he mentions that, you know. I mean, you can think about it like not every, you know, a lot of films, a lot of art have weird conservative kind of through lines. Like, not every great piece of art is thoroughly progressive.
Nothing is.
Right.
If it is, then it would be not progressive. Like, if every component of it fit the mold.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, because again, I only read 3 and 4, and the language of... Well, he didn't use the language of authenticity in 1 or 2, right? But he still mobilized it in the sense of the handicraft stuff. But even that receded for me in 3 and 4. Like, authenticity wasn't really much of a part of it. The essence was, but I've now, you know, we had talked several episodes past when you know, Deleuze uses the language of transcendence. It's like, I can no longer think of transcendence in that more traditional sense.
Right.
When I hear, I'm to the point with Heidegger, when he talks about essence, I can't hear it in that more traditional sense anymore. I still have a hard time with authenticity. I still have a hard time, like, you know, with the privileging, but I just didn't see that happening, at least in lectures 3 and 4.
Well, if we're going back to 3 and 4, there are a couple of places where I have oof. Right. This is my eye rolling at the grandfather, like the essence and the essential origin of the manner of knowing. You know, the those types of words are. You know, right. This doesn't lead to that. And I think part of what's behind the eye rolling for me is the sense that it's just unnecessary, right? Like he doesn't need he doesn't need to make the claim that he's after something that's more essential than when someone else is. He could simply be after something that's a different turn on it that enables a different orientation or a different attitude in his terminology, right? Like, he doesn't need to claim that he's after the essence of knowing. And I get your point, Nathaniel, which is you don't hear essence in the same way. I still hear it in that way. Like, I still hear, I've got the real one, or I have a sense of what the real one, quote unquote, is, because of course it isn't. It is this sort of projecting and receding. I mean, look, it's a question of an instrumental relationship to communication, because in those words, and Derrida does stuff with this with like 9/11, right? Like the sort of compacting of a whole dispersed series of phenomena and actions into a nominal, like an incredibly short form that we all act as if, oh, the you, or oh, you know, COVID, like we know what we're talking about there. So that, I mean, I get the critique, and I think that he's right. Like, I mean, that makes sense to me, because when one of the things that shortening of words indicates is that sort of all I'm interested in is the shortest way possible to communicate an idea to you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sort of thinking through that idea at all. That's why I'm shortening it. I mean, that's the basis for
but acronyms. The capacity, the ability to shorten it requires a whole lot of background infrastructure mm-hmm. that you're assuming in common, so that shortened That's word right. is now a technical attribution rather than a sight to think through.
Yeah. But the flip side is, and this is, you know, one of the bristling places for me, the flip side is that's true for every word.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true. Yeah.
That's what a word does. And so, yeah. and in all fairness, he is going to go after what words do, right? Yeah. Like, it's not like he's going to miss that point. But that's one of the functions of language is precisely this kind of sense of encapsulation, concretization, or freezing right. of, you know, freeze framing of a heterogeneous mass of phenomena.
And for somebody like Hegel, you know, in his articulation of the understanding or of any of those apparatuses, that's the primary function of language, of sense perception, is the reduction of complexity for use, for mobilization, application. And for Heidegger and for Nietzsche, that apparatus, if you want to call that kind of as a, like an emblem for the entire Hegelian system or for humanism, for whatever, for anthropomorphic thinking, that's the target, right? I mean, for Heidegger, for Nietzsche, maybe even for Deleuze to some extent, right? I mean, it's not just that they're after, it's not that Heidegger wants to access complexity that is being sort of forestalled or masked by language or by the faculty of the understanding. It's that he wants to, it seems like, foster some sort of more ethically attuned relation to the world, to your own relating to the world. How do you relate?
I think those would be the same thing. I mean, I would. So the attentiveness to it depends on what we mean by complexity, yeah. here, right? Like, but if what complexity means is just there are more parts, then you're right. It's not simply complexity. But yeah, I agree with you. His interest is in encouraging or fostering an attitude
right.
or disposition or, you know, my terminology. I mean, that's one of the things that came across. There were a couple of points in there where it's just like, when he talks about the tone of the sentence, like, this is what I'm calling style, you know.
Right.
And he talks consistently about, you know, like, the way of the thinking of the lectures being more important than any particular point that he's making.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, I get that. And I get that there is an attempt to encourage a different kind of disposition, not unrelated to how we started the conversation of, like, look, when I went into this, I was very frustrated because I couldn't pull out, you know, the sort of chunk, you know, the bumper sticker version chunks, and it took me a long time to get into the headspace to read with him.
Right.
You know, and when I did read with him, one of the things that I lost, one of the things that sort of fell to the wayside was a desire to criticize, to critique, to disagree, to say, oh, well, hold on a second. You know, that just because I was following something, right? I was riding the wave. I mean, sorry, I've been out on the water, but...
or even a desire... Even a desire to simplify, not even to critique, but right. to provide a summary or a glossary, because he even right. mentions that of, like, everybody wants to do that with Nietzsche, provide a glossary of terms, of concepts, a summary of the system so that it's more, you know, amenable or digestible.
Right. Usable.
Right, and it's like that's not the point of the thinking. The point is to follow the thinking somehow and interpret
it. It is the velocity that, yeah. you know, his... Part of the problem with the velocity of this technological nominalization that he has with is its speed. It doesn't
speed.
Just hypostasize, but it's a speed hypostasizing, yeah. right? Where you can right. move from one hypostasized point to the next quick, and he wants to get in and unravel them and follow them and figure out, you know, what their inclinations are. And so mm-hmm. he's very much so, like, instituting a... dialectic velocity that you brought up Derrida and Deleuze and others, and I read Deleuze to be faster in some yeah. ways, where, you know, rather than sitting and unraveling a concept, which I would say Derrida does as well, I would yeah. say Derrida is very slow in that way. Deleuze as putting concepts in relationship to each other and still very meticulously, right? You know, speed doesn't have to be sloppy, but meticulously experimenting with what those alliances do.
The terminology here is much more narrow, or it's much, you know, Deleuze will pull stuff from 1,000 different arenas, fields, and kind of make some sort of collage. Heidegger seems to use like 5 words total, you know, and just keep like meditating on them.
That's the beauty of the German language. You can just... Yeah. put those five together in a series of different combinations, and you have a book called Being in Time.
Right.
But I agree, and so that's where the sense of the speed. I agree that speed is quite important, but speed has, it's not simply about fast and slow, that there is something qualitative in speed that matters here as well. So that Deleuze's fastness in that regard, it's a tonal difference from Derrida's slowness or Heidegger's slowness, and yet they're invested in doing similar kinds of interruptions. Right. And so that's where I go, like, OK, it's not simply a question of fast, bad, slow, good. And I think Heidegger does sort of lean towards fast, bad, slow, good. I don't think that Derrida does. Like, no. I think that Derrida, you know, like that sort of the therapeutic style, what I use it for to read is a little more complicated in post Heidegger.
I think it does come to their relation to authenticity or to that concept, though.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
Heidegger's slowness is actively pushing against the speed of technology. And that's for right. someone like Deleuze, he's not interested in stripping away from modernity or something like that, right? He's interested right. in experimenting with the conditions that we have. Heidegger does, he has an interesting way of dealing with it in a few moments in these series. He doesn't simply want to, like, go back to the Greek age. Like, the nostalgia is, like, kind of more strangely articulated, where he basically wants to force your way out of the inauthentic relation. Like, where you have to push through it, through the last man, into the overman. Like, it's a very, it's a concerted, like, sort of, like, trembling effort, you know, to
see,
get...
See, that's where I think, I mean, you know, this is Derrida's line on Heidegger... you know, and it just makes sense to me that Heidegger sees Nietzsche as the last metaphysician because he foresaw the end of metaphysics, and Derrida's like, well, that makes Heidegger the last metaphysician, right? And I do sense that, because I, at least in terms of the Nietzsche that I read, which obviously goes through Derrida and Deleuze, you know, it can't not, but that's not, like, Nietzsche is not that simple. Right,
no.
Like, or it's that's a version of Nietzsche that, you know, worked in the early or the mid 20th century, but I don't think is that interesting anymore. But it does seem like that's Heidegger's. I mean, I agree with you that there is a kind of, and he will do a lot to massage this, but a kind of critique of modernity.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the baseline here. I don't get that in Deleuze. I don't get that in Derrida. You know.
I mean, you do get the sense that every philosopher kind of says that things are bad, but the approach to those things, like Heidegger, he does, like you're saying, he massages that point, but I find it to be similar to, because he says it can turn into a platitude. The wasteland
right.
grows can just turn into an empty platitude, and everybody can hang on to that because there's data, you know? People are dying, you know, that technology is alienating us. And at a certain point, everybody has access to that opinion. But Heidegger also says that. So it's like, it's hard mm-hmm. to distance him from that platitudinal approach.
But you also won't have Heidegger saying things like what Deleuze does in the Rhizome chapter of, like, write slogans, right?
Yeah, you're not going to see that.
he's not going to go there. I mean, it's still, again, and I like this. I mean, for me, it's kind of simple. Like, this is one flavor of thinking, and it really is functional and important, and I really, you know, I have a kind of admiration, fascination, compulsion towards it, but it's one, you know, it's not, or it's seven, but it's not everything, right? And it's not a telos, you know, it's, to me, I have a much more pragmatic relation, which is Heidegger when I'm angry, you know, Nietzsche when I'm sad,
mm-hmm.
right? Like,
yeah.
You know, these are the things that
it's like
me,
mood playlists on Spotify.
Right, that's
yeah.
what it is. It's
yeah.
a Spotify mood playlist of philosophy. Yeah. I mean, that's a little bit too reductive, but it's not terribly so. I mean, it's bad to think of it simply in terms of emotion, but think of it in terms of, like, you know, how my thinking is moving. Reading this does a certain kind of thing. Reading that, like, I didn't want to read Nietzsche last night, like, because if anything, Nietzsche just gets me more amped up, and I didn't need that. I wanted to get less amped up, you know.
I mean, or it just reveals the reductive way in which we tend to think about emotions as
yeah.
just the feeling, the quality right. of experience of being in this or that state, and you know, taking on a bit more of a robust orientation to it is like, you know, anger isn't just how I feel. Anger is a modality of relationship to myself, oneself, and everything else that shut down
yeah.
some kind modes, like ways of becoming and opens up others.
Right. I'm not sure, at least for me, I'm not sure that my particular organism, it opens up very much at all. Like it feels like that is the equivalent of the neurotic loop where I just cannot, I am just cycling through, you know, on the way paddling back. Like I had sort of sworn to myself that I wasn't going to think about the situation at South Carolina today, like, because there's nothing I can do today. And I just found myself unwillingly
to
just
not do it.
Playing yeah. the conversations and playing, you know, rephrasings in my head. And I'm trying, like, I even turned on my Marcus Aurelius audiobooks, like, you know, just trying to produce a different, it just didn't work.
Save me, Marcus.
Well, that's not, I mean, that's just what I have on the audiobooks, yeah. so, you know. But, and it just doesn't work, but it is a kind of, I mean, that really is why I'm writing about style, but I mean, it's just this sort of cultivating a kind of rhythm of my thinking that's more healthy. I mean, I don't, for lack of a better word, it just becomes, for me, that neurotic loop of anger becomes
right.
not generative and just relentlessly, like, this is, it's resentment, and I see it in myself, I know it in myself, I recognize it, and it's bad for this version of the organism.
Yeah, but I mean, that's, you know, Heidegger, Deleuze, everybody has some version of like thought thinks you, or language is that, all that stuff where it's like you don't have full authority over the over the movement of your thinking. So in some ways,
sure.
I mean, I don't know how, because obviously that dispositionally or affectively, that sucks to be in that zone. But like for yeah. someone like Heidegger, I mean, what would Heidegger's therapy session, if you were on the couch with Heidegger, what do you think he would tell you? Probably just to fucking move through it, you know? Like, I don't think he would have some, like, answer there. Because he understands, and he says it again and again, and Hegel does, and everybody, that you are guided by presuppositions, which, you know, so the unconscious, in some ways, is the director. I feel like the overman would be, at least the way it's articulated here, could be a useful way of thinking that charge. Because it's,
yeah.
I mean, the way we talked about it in your class a while ago, John, is that of course it's not a person. It's not Jeff Bezos, which is kind of what Heidegger says here. The overman is not...
Jeffrey Bezos!
It is not Elon Musk, it is not Jeffrey Bezos, it is not a politician, it is not a superhero... It is basically a state of potential, or it's something on the horizon that I guess you can aspire to, or it might be out. One of the interesting things that Heidegger said was that he might be out there,
yeah,
but you're
yeah.
never going to locate him.
Right.
You know?
There are instances of it
right.
In lots of places.
Right. But it's a name for an aspiration for change, basically, you know, of overcoming human constraints, which is... One way of dealing with the political ethical charges of our current predicament. So you could make the overman the figure for somehow overcoming our postmodern predicament, the coronavirus situation. You know,
yeah.
how would the overman respond to USC's fucked up response to the Delta variant?
The overman ain't fucking teaching modern rhetorical theory in a week.
Probably not. Probably not.
He's living in a cave somewhere.
Talking with his eagle.
Yeah.
Talking with the desert. Well, that's the Zarathustra.
That's thing. Zarathustra.
Because I do oftentimes think that the overman in terms of the figure is just a common... I mean, it's just like it's a dimension of futurity that's constitutive of like... anybody, right? Like it's not a person, it's not a goal. Even Heidegger thinks of it in terms of more goal-like than
right. yeah.
than I would have thought.
Yeah.
The overman can only be giving birth to, right?
Well, and then
yeah, that's the to me that's the crucial part for Nietzsche is there's no it's just give birth to the Overman. It's not be the Overman.
Well, and then Heidegger, it's like, yeah. There's just one sentence, but it's like the Overman comes into being as soon as he dies. So it's like its generation, its generativity is when it passes away, which is just
like give birth to it, because the second it's given, it can't be, right? It can only become.
Right.
I mean, it is sort of like that figure of, as John said, futurity or like the change into.
But would the Overman, like, because you guys have talked about this in relation to Deleuze's thinking, like that kind of zone you get in when you're, or flow state, when you're able to kind of channel your thinking and writing in a productive way, and you can effectively feel it. Would that be like, in Heidegger's terms here, would that be somehow channeling that energy? This sounds now very like mystical, the way I'm putting it, but.
I don't know. I mean, and I know that this isn't answering your question, it's just shifting it, but I always think of the importance of the concept of the Overman is the call for the Overman, not the Overman.
Right.
You know, and which is not to say that the Overman, even as a call, doesn't have attributes, but that those aren't the important dimensions of it. Or maybe the attributes are so vague as to be determinable in whatever form every call takes.
Right.
Right. That the, right. You know, that might be, it's like the messianic without messianism. That Derrida takes from Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of how I think of it. But that doesn't really answer, that doesn't answer your question. Like, it can do all kinds of work depending on the circumstance.
I guess...
There might be an interesting location to think that question, because, you know, when you're talking about the zone or the flow or whatever, you know, I tend to talk about that in terms of kairos, and especially sort of like embodied senses of kairos, and like being in the zone playing a basketball game or you know, whatever, or in the zone of writing or whatever else it is. And you know, it is an interesting question to ask, like, does the figure of the Overman play, or does it complicate that picture that we've given, you know, so frequently, where, you know, to be in the zone in the game is in some ways to be taken by the game. The division between me and the game has been rendered meaningless, and, you know, my play in the game is part of simply like its own futurity, its own becoming. So, I mean, is there sort of like a point of conflation of, you know, like the kairotic moment as it, you know, merges with the Overman? The figure of the Overman.
Maybe my problem is that I want to kind of concretize the concept, and the point of the concept is precisely not to be put into simplified terms. It's not a state of being, you know.
But that's okay, because I think there's nothing else you can do other than that, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I just we'd have to do something with Kairos and with the game to take it away, just like we'd have to do this with the things that I was saying earlier about anger and whatever, to take it away from a simply individualized experience,
right?
You know, and to think of it as a sort of social force, but yeah, why not? I mean, why not envision overmanness as being this sort of dimension of. Again, the hard thing there has to be a component of overcoming of what is. There has to be, right? Like, so it can't simply be, and this is a lot of times the way of thinking of being in the zone is like, I am so fully connected to what is, even though I'm subverting, I'm unconscious, right? That's the expression with basketball. He was unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's subverting consciousness, it's still like, I am so in tune with what is. And so, it can't
but
be
what,
that. Like,
what could a game? What could it mean to be there is in a game which is so fully flow?
Right. It's constantly moving and changing, but also within the dimensions of a game, you know, within a sort of confined game. So I don't know. I mean, I see something to the experience of the being in the zone that matters. I have often thought of it in terms of Kairos, but I haven't really connected that with the Overman. But give it a shot, man. I mean, if that interests you, why not, right? Like, in recognizing the perils, of course, of, like, I don't want to make this simply a present entity, even as an experience. But nevertheless, this is a way of thinking of it. That seems viable.
Well, right? I mean, like, look, I'm not committed to it. I was just throwing it out there as a possibility. But, you know, we can think about...
basketball players that have changed the game. Let's take like Steph Curry most recently. That for him to be, you know, in the game in that way of being unconscious of slipping into the flow of the game changed the game.
Yeah.
Right. And so you say the within the confines of the game, but let's not pretend like the confines of the game are stabilized beyond the least interesting version of like 94 feet by 34
yeah,
feet.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree. It's the sort of tactical dynamics of team play. Yeah, I get that. I agree with that.
Right.
Yeah, so, as long as you're creating a non-individuated, you can even talk about it in terms of a person. It just can't be simply individuated. It can't simply be a personal experience.
Right.
And it has to be, for the Overman to make sense, it has to have some sense of overcoming the human, right? Like it has to have that. Now, that everything then depends, of course, on how one determines the human and what one means by overcoming.
Well, so what would it mean? Because, you seem to be suggesting that it has to be a kind of collective transformation in some way. But what I'm struggle, because again, I feel like I want to oversimplify the concept and like turn it into like when you catch fire in a basketball game, you're somehow accessing the overman. Like when traditionally you're the last man or you're embodying resentment most of your life. And then there's these moments when you catch fire. You know, and you're suddenly channeling something extra human, otherworldly, whatever. You know, and that doesn't seem quite right, like in the way it's articulated.
And again, I am just following this. I'm not committed to anything that I'm saying. But to say that Steph Curry changed the game of basketball isn't to say that there is a person who has exerted a force or a will. Like Steph Curry changed the game of basketball for Steph Curry as well.
Yeah.
Right. That you have to take Steph Curry as the kind of affective introduction or the introduction of some antigen into the game of basketball that changed it, and Steph Curry the person that continues to play the game on any given night. Like, think about the way that he's transformed what the basketball human could be. Like, imagine, you know, the epitome. Like, Shaq is one of the best players of all time. Could Shaq play in contemporary NBA? And you know the answer is probably yes. And you know
Shaq could because he's Shaq. I mean,
but he didn't change the game though. He was an anomaly,
right? You know, what I mean? That's a huge difference. Yeah. Like exactly right. Mm-hmm. He didn't change the game at all. He was just an unbelievably dominant force just because of his size and skill.
Yeah.
Back on the question of the zone, I honestly, I don't know. I mean, it seems like such a foreign connection to me to think of it in terms of to connect the Kairos and the zone to the Overman.
Yeah.
Because I guess maybe in part because I always feel like the Overman is a project. And it only makes sense to me to think of it as a project, which is the overcoming of the human.
Right.
And that doesn't mean eradicating the species Homo sapien. It means making that species function in a different way. But I don't think of that as zone. I think of that because to me, at its best, being in the zone, yes, it does. I mean, yes, Steph Curry did change the game. I mean, I don't doubt that. But by and large, there's no overcoming of humanity there. There is humanity at its most excellent and extraordinary. But there's no sort of basic, there's no alteration to most of the attributes that I would associate with the human going on. I love it. It gives me hope. I mean, it really, I've said that before, right? The thing I love about sports is those occasional moments where you see in a pressure-packed situation, most of us, myself included, drop in our performance. Some amazing people stay the same.
Right.
But then there's those like few of them that the Jordans that get better. And I always just find that, I don't even know what the right, it's just hopeful. Like when I witness that, I'm just like, there is potential for this species.
So it's sort of more, it's like an enhancement of human capacity rather than a transformation of what it means to be a human. Like at least if we're thinking in Heidegger's terms here, he talks about a qualitative change, not a quantitative.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I guess, you know, catching fire like Steph Curry does or like Damian Lillard in that one playoff game where he just kept pushing them into overtime. I mean, you're watching something amazing, but it's not like Damian transformed into something that was not human. He was enhancing, you know.
Although I get what he did, and I think there's something very interesting in that. I mean, I remember the one time in my life in an organized basketball game that ever happened for me. And it was just, it's so summed up by the Michael Jordan image when he, you know, against the Pacers, I believe it was, right? When he's walking back and he does the, to the bench.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did I do?
I don't know what's going on. And I remember that feeling of, it doesn't matter. Like, I could throw the ball up and it's going in. And it's not me who's in charge of that. I think that there is something conceptually very, you know, something interesting worth thinking about in those moments. I don't feel like the project of the Overman is doesn't immediately hook into that for me, but that doesn't mean that you can't do that, right? Like, I mean, I would say, like,
to put it back into Heidegger's terminology a little bit, what makes this concept strange to me, because Heidegger's obviously invested in it a lot, is its relation to authenticity, because to strip everything of what it means to be a human, you would think would be some sort of inauthentic relating. But he wants to either come back to something or facilitate an engagement that is in some way authentic. But the Overman, how is that? I mean, again, it can make sense for Heidegger. I just don't know how to articulate that right now. Like, the relationship between the
Overman. I think the authenticity has anything to do with stability for Heidegger. No. Right, because I do think that there is an auto-generating, auto-transformative, like, relationship to aletheia. I mean, like, it's not like something is disclosed and then it stays that way. Like, movement into disclosure is going to create other disclosures and other, you know, I mean, it's going to shut down, redirect, it's going to incline you in this or that direction. Mm-hmm. And so it is a fundamentally transformative process, and that's a weird combination to think about authenticity as also self-transformative and not stabilizing. And this leads me, I mean, I'm not like married to having to continue to think about the relationship between the zone Kairos and the Overman. But there is a way that we have a tendency of making moments of Kairos too rare, right? It's like, I'm in the zone, I'm out of the zone. It's like, no, I'm always in a zone. I just might not be in that zone or the zone that I want to, right? I'm always in a zone. I'm never hypostasized, right? Hypostasizing itself is an activity of becoming that, you know, we might call it an extreme slowing down, but there is still movement. And then so, like, I think about something like the Overman as if it could have clear parameters. Like, what would it be? What could it mean for the human not to be in the process of overcoming itself?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? Even and what's interesting about returning it back to Heidegger is it would seem like the human's authentic relationship to itself would be of a style of overcoming the human.
Well, so that's where, I mean, and I think you probably just didn't get to that. I think it might be in lecture 5, but the last man, the figure of the last man is for him basically the human that has ceased overcoming himself.
Right.
Which seems to be the case for Nietzsche.
Like, well, a sedentary, resentiment relates to that a little bit too. Yeah, like, which is what, there's all these contradictions that are productive, but they're just strange to me. Like, Heidegger's invested in quietness and slowness, but that quiet persistence of subjectivity is also the target. So it's like when you just move about your day and do the thing, you know, go to your job and all that stuff, that's bad in some way for Heidegger because you're not accessing.
But I think one of the things that I give him credit, and I like this, is, you know, and he uses the word tone there, but, he, you know, making the distinction, like, look, all kinds of experiences have different tones. And he takes that sentence, you know, his sentence of we are still not thinking, and he begins with, like, look, there's an obvious tone in which one can hear that, and it's the negative tone. Everything sucks today, and, you know, and that's familiar. And it's not that that's simply absent, but he's after a different tone in that, which is we are almost there, we are getting close, we are on the way. So this sort of positive or hopeful tone, that's both of them are available in the sentence. So the problem, of course, is thinking that the sentence just means something. And that what you need to do is, for him, and that's the slowness, you need to patiently attend to the different tones available in this, and that's what he's doing via lecturing, is trying to get you to hear the tone. And I think it's the same thing for the Overman, is that, like, look, there's a tone to humanity that's it's available there, that is the overcoming of itself. It's just kind of overshadowed by a different kind of tone, which is representational thinking, technological ways of living. So my guess is, I mean, this is back to the kind of therapy cover, like, you know, Heidegger's vision of this future, of this imaginable future world, and I give him credit for this, is just to inject a little more slowness and a little more, his word would be care, right? Like, in for being in time, would be a little carefulness, care in relation to the thinking. And I love that, right? Like, I mean, I'm totally on board with that. In that tone, you know, it's like, that's what he's doing, and that's what I got from it when I read it, is, again, whatever the claims are about this or that, are less important than the reading of Heidegger. I mean, I know I say that shit all the time, and I know it just becomes banal, but,
and it seems like sometimes, I mean, at least in the mode of teaching or of pedagogy, it's like finding not the appropriate tone, but finding a tone that works, that will, you know, allow people to engage, or that forces people to engage.
To use Heidegger's word, what's the tone that will involve my students?
Right, so the quiet tone can sometimes be effective and can create a storm of thinking, or the you know, he talks about Nietzsche screaming, even though it's kind of a quiet sentence, you know, the wasteland grows. He's like, Nietzsche screamed that sentence to allow for the quietness of thinking through, you know, the conceptual work. So it's like, right. Yeah. Right.
But I like that. I mean, I like that. Now, for instance, where it goes for Heidegger in terms of poetry as being a more, I don't know, authentic relation to language than other. I mean, I don't think it has to go there. In fact, I go quite the opposite, which is, like, look at all the poetry in everyday conversation, or if you have to call it poetry, I'd rather not. Like, look, you know, simply say there are different tones available in language of all kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is, yeah, so what the project, or what my project, and quite honestly, like, I, you know, one of the things that, that happened to me in the course of reading the Heidegger last night and realizing, first of all, how difficult it was and truly, like, physically painful. Like, I don't want to be doing this. It's angering me. It's not getting me out of my anger. It's frustrating me even more. But that it transitioned, right, and I got hooked in. And I was like, one of the big thoughts for me that just popped into my head that I kept returning to was, this is why I want to write, is because it can do that.
Right.
Not that it always does do that, and certainly not that it's going to do that for everyone, but, like, you know, to the extent that I feel truly thankful to live in a world in which Nietzsche and Derrida and Deleuze wrote, like, I'm truly thankful, like, that yeah. has made my life better,
yeah.
then I need to do that, right, and put it out there. And again, it doesn't, I'm not saying everyone's going to read this thing, but that's something that it can do.
Right.
And that's something that Heidegger did. If Heidegger does nothing else other than do what it did for me last night reading, it was worth reading Heidegger.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a value, right? Like, that's introducing a tone, a new tone. I don't know if it's new or not. It doesn't matter if it's new or not. Introducing a different tone into a system that's doing this, like, frazzled, frantic thing.
Yeah.
And that allows it to... You know, I don't want to start using words like harmonious, because I'm going to start sounding new agey as well. But it you know, produces a shift in that enabled me to just sort of, like, calm the fuck down. And
Right.
That's an incredibly productive.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I know it's not, it doesn't do that for everyone. And I know there are times where I've read Heidegger where all it did was infuriate me, you know, and.
Well, even if the conceptual, just real quick, even if the conceptual work is ambiguous and difficult, you are locating yourself in that ambiguity. So it's still the therapeutics of, like, finding the thread. And, like, you find Nietzsche in those couple passages, and then you lose him. And then Heidegger talks about, like, that dialectic or whatever, but the importance of finding somebody and then losing them and then finding them. But, yeah.
Which, it made me think of you when I read that particular passage, when he's like, okay, when he gets to the point of, like, finding Nietzsche, we need to lose him. And I'm like, that is just straight up Right, like that's not even subtly Hegelian.
Yeah. Right. Super Hegelian, yeah.
Yeah, it's just overtly Hegelian. Not that everything's not Hegelian, but some of the things just really strike me at times. And for instance, the being face-to-face with the tree.
That reminded me of Hegel's bit on the tree and the house and the generic implementation of universal concepts. And
Totally.
It really did. But see, and the problem with that, of course, and like, I get it. I get the distinction that he's after, which is there are different ways of facing a tree, right? Some of which seem more full and some of which are more instrumental, right? Like, I get that. That makes sense. And I think those distinctions matter. And I think we don't have a good vocabulary for talking about those styles or comportments or dispositions. But then, and you haven't gotten to this yet, I don't know if you did or not, Nate, but then he's like, well, dogs can't, you know, be face-to-face.
No, I did read that. I was like, well, why? Yeah.
Why not, right? Like, dogs can't have a face because they don't have the ratio and they don't have language.
Right, right.
And it's like...
They can be snout-to-snout?
They can still orient to a tree. Like, why not? Right. Yeah.
I know. And also, just, like, what extraordinary... I mean, because he lays out that chain of being thing, and I thought what he was going to do was this very classical... I thought he was going to do this kind of very classical move of saying, you know, humans don't have any particular... They're indeterminate, which is the claim he takes from Nietzsche, because they don't have any particular essence.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is... That's the kind of conventional claim of humanism, you know, is that there's no necessary essence to humans. However, they are on this chain of being, and that chain goes from the physical to the spiritual, and the further you move up by using reason, the better off you are. That's the humanist mantra. But there's no necessary location of the human. We just have the potential to be gods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was going to problematize that, and he fucking didn't. Like, he really just kind of bought the chain of being thing of the ratio and its relationship to phusis. Like, we are metaphysical, you know, we are the physical that aspires to go beyond the physical,
right?
And
which is Dasein. I mean, we're the being that thinks it's being.
That's right. I mean, it is totally.
Yeah.
So that's the place where I start going, all right, granddad.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point where you've just gone a little too far into, you know, your racist asides.
Yeah, you know? Your animal hatred. There's no animal studies in these few lectures, I don't think.
Or the privileging and centrality of the human. It's like, you know, there's a way in which, and again, I understand that it's historical, and at a substantial level, this doesn't matter all that much. But he just does seem tied to this notion of the sort of, I don't know, the privilege and importance of his version of non-presence being the attribute.
He did,
and again,
to me though, when he kind of gives the definition of the metaphysical, and he goes through the sensual and the conceptual, and then this is how we kind of achieve this state of being, it did feel like there were some inherent contradictions there. Like, he seemed to be pointing out the arbitrariness, what is the word, of those distinctions, right? I mean, because, like, it's like we've emplaced that definition, right? So he does seem to at least point to the performative instantiation of the metaphysical rather than, like, just that is what we are. You know, and so.
But it just buys. I mean, there's a totally different. I mean, take the Deleuze, what I would call the Deleuze tack of multiplicity into that problem, and rather than sort of like, hey, we need to push the human further, be like, what the fuck is human?
Yeah.
Like, we have never been that, and so that category itself is the thing. So that's like imploding it rather than, you know, moving beyond it.
Well, because I'm thinking about the paradigmatic example for Nietzsche, which is Christianity. Christianity the hatred of life, period, right? Yeah. And, like, there are some ways you just want to be like, it's not even the introduction of an arbitrary set of norms for what counts of life. It's just like Christian theology sort of like condemns this life for the sake of a non-life, an afterlife. That's pretty motherfucking life deprecating. But... you know, you would have to, you know, you'd have to allow for the possibility of saying, it's not the only life, and this other life in the clouds looks pretty cozy to me. So, here's one mode of life. Hate life so I can have another life.
Well, or it just, and it produces ways of being in the world, right? Like, so, I mean, Christians live in certain kind of ways. Obviously, it's multiple and diffuse, but so the belief in an afterlife and that even if you accept Nietzsche's diagnosis as life deprecating, it's still a mode of life. And he will say, right, like in his better moments, he'll say what you want. It's still will to power, right? It is. And that's where you just say, look, that's where multiplicity becomes crucial to me, is you have different modes of life who walk around living in different ways, some of which some people would call life deprecating, others of which they would call life enhancing. And there isn't a governing answer. There is simply, like, we can't get outside of that problem to say, is that really life deprecating or is it really life affirming?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, no. I mean, the belief in an afterlife produces ways of acting in the world.
Which like sort of, like, forces you to be in a position where, like, yeah, like, what happens when I like spicy food isn't just an assertion, a reflection of my own personal taste that I can never push on someone, but it's worth me pushing. Yeah, like it's worth, like you're saying that, you know, a certain orientation to COVID is worth pushing on other people, right?
That's
despite
right.
the
That's
fact
right.
that there isn't a transcendent, like you don't
That's
get
right.
to feel right or justified in it, but you're still going to push for it, right?
That's exactly right. Like it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have that meta top down. You can say, look, I can see what the result of your approach to COVID is, and it's that people get sick and
like
die.
It.
Yeah.
yeah,
and my
but that doesn't get but that doesn't give like the fact that look, my approach to COVID is far less likely to make people get sick and die, and yours isn't. But that then doesn't give me license to some kind of self-righteousness. To
I don't have a transcendent. Yeah, I don't have a transcendent position. I am working.
But doesn't take away. But doesn't take away the capacity to attack.
That's exactly right.
Like,
it doesn't.
I'm not justified in this. I'm not licensed it. But motherfucker, I'm still coming after you.
So now you see. Okay, here that point is, I think, one that analytic the types that call themselves analytic philosophers can never hear, which is there is, in other words, what you're saying is there is no ground and there does not need to be for action. Right?
Right.
There just doesn't need to be. It's
no.
unnecessary. And so the desire to find a ground, again, that's one kind of life, right? It's like I must have a basis for my morality, utilitarianism, deontological, whatever it may be, right? I must have some sort of basis. Like, no, you don't. You don't have to do. That's why I've always said, like, how does Nietzsche substantiate his truth claims? He says them.
Right.
Yeah. And like, look, substantiating, basing, grounding, right? You know, they're not really grounded. They're not really substantiated. They're not really
performatively enacted.
But they're performatively enacted that are going to gain traction with certain kinds of modes of thinking and are going to create resistances to other modes of thinking too.
Right.
right?
That's right. That's why performativity is crucial, right? Like performativity can get you away from logic. Logic as a necessary basis, because
right.
you say logic would itself be performatively instantiated. There doesn't
right.
have to be.
Performativity pulls logic up to its
right.
level rather than
that's right.
it as
and
the grounding.
The other
that's
aspect
right.
of this problematic that I'm thinking of right now is that like complexity of deconstruction or whatever of these philosophical systems does not necessitate nihilism or inactivity, which is kind of a common accusation that like, if you really think through all this and if there is no ground to reality or being, then it's going to lead to, well, anything goes, you know. And that's not the case. I mean,
absolutely
think
not.
Of Hegel and Derrida specifically. I mean, they were very politically active and they made decisions. So it doesn't preclude the possibility of making concrete decisions.
But I'd even go further than that. Look at the history of humanity. None of the decisions and none of the actions have actually had grounds that weren't simply performatively produced.
Right.
And yet we've done a whole lot of shit and encouraged certain behaviors and discouraged other behaviors.
Right.
So we don't have to have the basis in a God. What we have to have is the claim to a basis in a God.
Right. The performative. You need
right.
the performative.
Right.
Yeah.
That subject doesn't have to pre-exist. It is retroactively installed as pre-existing.
Right. And maybe, I mean, would the argument be that most people need the figure of a ground?
Well, you hypostasize
yeah.
it, right? Like, you
yeah.
hypostasize and you say, well, if it's retroactively installed as pre-existing. This is Lacan on the real,
yeah.
by the way, right?
Yeah.
Like, the retroactive installation of its preexistence is exactly that kind of logic. And yeah, like, in order to have force, in order to be persuasive, people need, you know, humans, and this is a characteristic of humanity. They right. need to believe that it comes from somewhere that's not another person.
Right.
If it's simply another person's, like, right. I claim this, then that is what's called doxa or opinion or whatever. We need caddy on here.
Yeah, we do. I mean, but at point, because like at least in the 70s and you know the reception of Derrida, and then today even you right. find the dangers, you know, people, the yeah. accusations of the dangers of deconstruction.
Never made any sense to me. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, the idea that we're getting rid of values because there is no ontological basis in God or in reason or logic, because those things don't function as bases, that suddenly anything goes and there's no, it's like, no, that's never been the case.
Right.
And right. That's where it just doesn't make the claim of that version of nihilism attributed to so-called postmodernity is just.
Right. Right.
It's
yeah.
so logic based. Like, in order to make that claim, you have yeah. to believe there has to be a suprasensory basis
yeah.
for everything in order for anything to exist. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Why?
Which means everything has to be the correct or the incorrect, the better or the worse, the closer to the logically, you know, justifiable or further yeah. away from it.
I mean, if you just take a sheerly sociological version, you know, of humanity, you don't need any of those things. You just need the claim to those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And the repetition of the claim and the habituation of practices right. associated with the claim, right? Like, all of those things. I mean, I firmly believe, like, if you could get 10,000 Americans to believe, you know, just pick anything, that, like, owls are saviors, you know, I just, whatever. like, and you get their families to reproduce that for five generations, there will be an owl religion in a thousand years.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and sure. it's that simple sociologically. Now, again,
right.
it can't seem necessarily that arbitrary, but the things that people believe today in terms of, for instance, Christianity, they are 100% a result of a historical accretion of the repetition of practices
yeah.
of, I promise you, something some dumbass folks concocted at some point to be like, hey, I know how we can get people to do shit. Let's tell them it's God.
Right.
Right. Though, I mean, you know, it's that move to say, like, look, the you know, truths are made or practices are habituated. And I really like that line in Heidegger's, like, what are you talking about, like, habituation without a notion of, or a habit without a notion of habituation, right? Like,
oh, yeah,
habits
yeah.
are, you know, always habituated.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. You know, habits have to be, like, it's too easy to isolate a habit in and of itself. Like, the repetition of, you know, take Nietzsche's example in Truth and Lies, the repetition of leaf, 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 leaf,
right?
right? And
there are
reasons why leaf got, you know, repeated and habituated in ways that other possibilities didn't. And it's
sure.
not because leaf is truer right. in a transcendent way, but because it has different points of contact with existing other habituations. And so,
sure.
you know, like, there is a field of habituations that make the emergence of some new, you know, things more or less likely, and, you know, puts
right.
our savior religion on the less likely than
That's
on
right.
the more
right.
likely, not because it has anything to do with its, you know, its correspondence with the transcendent
That's
truth.
Right. With its truth. Right.
Right.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, you know, what follows from that is an incredible, I mean, I don't know, like, an incredible freedom on the one hand, right, which is like, hey, there's no basis other than history and sociology for anything, you know, but also an incredible terror, right, for, I think, a lot of people of, like, wait, you're saying they're really, like, I mean, this is the Nietzsche assassin creed moment, you know, nothing is true, everything is permitted. It really is. Everything really is permitted. It just doesn't, that doesn't mean there won't be consequences
yeah.
for things that you do.
Right.
But everything,
for everything
really,
you do. Yeah.
right. Like, but,
yeah.
but everything is permitted. There is no larger than life base, you know, other than sociological basis for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
but I do think, I mean, and Nietzsche says this as well, like, the perpetual performative enactment of a ground to reality, does, it's like a sedative, you know, for the
yeah,
the general
yeah.
population.
Yeah.
And I think to a certain extent, like, having someone like Trump in office, you know, who could be thought of as like the naked lunch, you know, he kind of exposes the cracks in the system, does lead to chaos. I mean, it's chaotic, right? I mean, because people need, like, we had said for, even though it was a lie, we'd said for years, democracy, president, stability, all these things. And then all of a sudden, every average Joe has access to a panoply of conspiracy theories that lead to non-faith in the government in any sense of reality. I mean, I think it is dangerous, at least on a like a practical level, right? For just for the whole population to have some sort of just kind of vague
for the herd,
right? For the herd.
Well, I was gonna say, well, it's dangerous for us as we're living now in this moment,
right?
Right, like it is.
Yeah.
It's created dangers. Now that matters. I mean, like in other words, I want social stability,
right?
Right. And I want it because it enables all kinds. Enables.
Lets
me
do whatever I
want to
do. Yeah, live my life.
Yeah, right.
You know, play basketball, teach.
But there's no. But it's not because I'm not. It's not because I'm right
about
the desire for social stability. It's because that's the thing that I want. Because
it's a selfish desire. Yeah.
Well, it needn't even be selfish. Like, it could be like, hey, it's better for more people. Like, I could make some kind of utilitarian argument. It doesn't have to be selfish. But the basis is a social basis. It can't be anything but that.
Yeah.
And so it can't be because I'm right. Because it's not that. Because, for instance, one could make a potentially interesting argument, which is this sort of, because I think that a lot of what drives these folks really is a desire to burn everything down, right? Like that's, it's just like anything that looks like structure and stability needs to get burned down. Well, man, there's a way of seeing that as an incredibly inventive exercise so that you could say, like, actually the kind of Trump-inspired movement of angry stupidity that is filtering could be the absolute best thing for the emergence of the Overman.
Right.
Right? Like, there's an argument, and that makes sense. That's imaginable, right? That's imaginable as a possible eventuality to me, or creating the baseline conditions for a new and higher and better form of life than humanity as we kill ourselves. That's imaginable to me.
Yeah.
Right? It's just not one that I want to participate in.
Yeah,
as a living being at this time,
I'd like to delay that anarchy a little bit. You know, I like my comfort. You know,
give it another 70 years,
yeah, and
it's like a different question. I mean, you guys can go ahead and do that fucking thing. But I mean, and that's the problem, is that there's always people, you know, along that scale who like don't want that thing, so they want the structure and stability. So we want the Jeffrey Bezos, right? Like we or as a symptom of a certain kind of, and so we want that, and again, like, the question is not which one is better for humanity, which one is more life-affirming, is an impossible, and this is Nietzsche, it's an impossible question to ask as a participant in life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't get outside of being a participant in life and say, what's better for the species?